The show goes on. This is the official show on the Fish Tribes podcast channel, where we cover the Miami Marlins every day in our own way. I am Eli Sussman, the managing editor of Fish Tribes. Wherever you're listening to this pod, please rate and review and subscribe so that you get all of our episodes as well. Fast approaching the regular season. This episode is supposed to come out on Monday morning, but I rushed it for what are very obvious reasons to react to the news of Jorge Soler signing with the Marlins. A new format of our podcasting schedule kind of it started last week. This will be the first real full week that we are getting it done, where you'll have me on the official show, usually dropping on Monday mornings and Thursday mornings. You'll have the normal Big Fish Small Pod with Daniel Rodriguez and A.T. Werdahl on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays. And so on my Monday episodes, to just create some continuity to get us, make sure we're covering every weekday, I'm going to start off our Monday pods with a small pod portion where I'll run through just some big storylines around the Marlins in recent days in 10 minutes or less. Then we're going to go to a commercial. Then we're going to come back from a commercial with my main topic and analysis on the Marlins for that episode. So is that clear? This should give you a good example as we try out that format. The Marlins just started their Grapefruit League schedule on Friday and then played again on Saturday. 2-0 start to the spring training schedule for the Marlins. That's nothing new. We know this team for each of the last 4 years, they've had winning records in Grapefruit League play. Certainly looks like it'll be that case again, dealing with a shortened schedule and getting off to such a hot start. Friday's opener started by the presumptive opening day starter in the regular season for the Marlins, Sandy Alcantara. He was perfect, literally perfect. 9 up, 9 down, facing the Washington Nationals, facing a Nationals lineup that I will add was close to full strength. Not totally. They may have been missing Nelson Cruz in that game. Just about everybody else was in there. And it was at least somewhat of a reminder. You don't want to overreact to the results, but it was somewhat of a reminder that the Nationals are not going to be particularly good this year. I think any rational person would think that the Marlins, especially in light of this latest signing, seem to be pretty safely out of the cellar in the National League East this upcoming season. Marlins won that game 8-3 over the Nationals. We got another spring training home run for Jazz Chisholm Jr. He's been great in spring training. You may remember at this time last year when he was competing for the second base job against Eson Diaz, his home run in the opening game of that spring training schedule certainly set the tone that he would ultimately earn that job over Eson. No controversy whatsoever entering this spring. He is pretty well set as the everyday second baseman for the Marlins in 2022. And as if that was in any doubt, he hit a 3-run homer against Josh Rogers, the left-handed pitcher that you may remember from last season, taunted him about his Eurostep celebration. Jazz was able to get his revenge with a home run against Josh Rogers. An equally big offensive impact in this one from Lorenzo Quintana, the 33-year-old catcher slash DH slash first baseman. I was surprised how many people were unaware of him when he had this big hit, but he was in the Marlins organization last year. They did make a midseason trade to acquire him as minor league depth from the Astros. So this was his first spring training as a member of the Marlins organization. He got off to a good start. Very doubtful that he sneaks onto the opening day major league roster. Yet he's somebody to keep an eye on for at some point this year making a debut. And it would be a really fun story as a 33-year-old who is this close to reaching the majors, but has a pretty nice track record of being able to hit in the minors. It'd be fun to give him an opportunity at some point down the line. Moving on to Saturday, Marlins win again, this one against the Astros 10-2. Another commanding victory. This one, a different vibe around it though, because the Astros did not send anybody recognizable. I pride myself on following every team, at least to a certain degree, and I did not recognize anybody that was in this game for the Astros. I could be wrong. I don't think more than a couple of them had any major league experience, and they certainly were not the familiar faces that have led the Astros to being very good teams year in and year out. The Marlins caught a break here, and they took care of business. We had three home runs by Avisiel Garcia, by Brian Anderson, by Gerard Encarnacion. In particular, the Garcia and Encarnacion home runs were no doubters. I can't even remember which one was the longest. I think Gerard's was actually longer. Avisiel was only 449 feet, and Gerard even longer than that. You'll remember 2 years ago, in Gerard's first year, I think on the 40-man roster, he put on a show that spring as well, showing power to all fields. That there's no doubt about that when it comes to his skill set. The question is kind of everything else, whether he's really an outfielder or a first baseman. The swing and miss issues he had last year at AA were really concerning. It's a very critical year in his development, entering his age 24 season. And the Brian Anderson home run, it should not be overlooked. He had another at-bat in that game where he hit it all the way to the warning track at Roger Dean. For somebody that is coming off of shoulder surgery, really the main concern that I had about BA is exactly what the power would look like, especially early in the year. So for him to show it a little bit in this game, that is a nice step in the right direction. On the pitching side, Pablo Lopez started this game and is now lined up as the number two starter for the Marlins. That may be slightly surprising that he is one spot ahead of Trevor Rogers in that order. Will Stewart in relief. There were, four relievers that came to finish this game off behind Pablo, and Will Stewart pitched three scoreless innings coming out of the pen, getting stretched out as a starter where he'll go either to AA or to AAA this season. One of the pieces from the JT Realmuto, Sixto Sanchez, Jorge Alfaro trade. So he's still around. He opened my eyes a little bit. The fact that he reached all the way up to 94 miles per hour from the left side with his fastball. He's not known for that velo. That's something to keep an eye on, is whether that carries over to full-length starts during the regular season. Through those first two spring training games, the Marlins outscoring their opponents 18-5, and there are, by my count, only a small number of position players that have not gotten into those games. For the most part, they went with almost entirely different groups of hitters for the opener on Friday versus the second game on Saturday. The ones we are still waiting to see in game action are Williams Astudillo, Delino DeShields, Santiago Chavez, and Jose Devers. And unofficially waiting for the debut of Jorge Soler. Breaking news on Saturday night, we find out a 3-year, $36 million contract for Jorge Soler. That was somewhat on the high side of what he was projected to get coming off his World Series MVP performance. As I've spotlighted a couple times on social media, Miguel Rojas has been advocating for this since early in the offseason. He perhaps optimistically willed it into existence when he predicted that Soler would sign a 3-year deal with the Marlins.
So I'm going to pick Soler to come here for 3 years.
Prediction from almost 4 months ago has finally come to fruition. A unique contract structure for sure. It has opt-outs after each of the first 2 years of that deal. It's just going year by year with him. And it's a $12 million salary for this upcoming season. If he stays, $15 million for year two in 2023, followed by $9 million in the final year of the deal that also has $4 million of potential bonuses. He can reach those bonuses depending on a number of plate appearances that he gets. So maximum value of the deal would be $40 million over those 3 years. And although, as I said, this is on the high side of what he was projected to get entering free agency, when you put it head-to-head with the Nick Castellanos deal, that was 5 years, $100 million. The Kyle Schwarber deal, 4 years, $79 million. And as I record this, we're still waiting for a resolution on Michael Conforto's free agency. I think the opinion is certainly that he'll get more on an annual basis than Soler is getting on this one, but how much of a discrepancy, that will play a large role in whether or not the Marlins actually made the right choice here. So they had alternatives. A couple of them that are off the board would have been a whole lot more expensive for guys that are about the same age as Soler, entering his age 30 season. As of this recording, only 19 days until opening day. It's just a fraction of what you'd normally get over the course of a full spring training. There's a question about, you know, exactly how much time is needed for both pitchers and position players to get fully up to speed for the regular season. With Soler, it's now a maximum of 13 games until spring training games, until opening day. And realistically, this deal isn't even official yet. So more likely, he's going to have no more than 11 or 12 games to get tuned up for the regular season. And hopefully that is enough time. They were really not just testing the fans' patience. They were really just pushing the edge on, you know, a realistic, I should say, like runway for what a player needs in order to get his timing back at the plate, a certain amount of reps that are needed, all the stuff that happens behind the scenes to get familiar with your teammates and your coaching staffs, to understand their philosophies and all that. So it takes time. You can't just do it at the very last minute and expect that player to perform up to expectations unless they are given that luxury. The bottom line is Soler should provide a substantial boost to their offense, which we know has been holding back this team in recent years. For the main body of this podcast, we're going to get into the five big questions that I have coming off of this Jorge Soler signing. As I said a moment ago, $36 million guaranteed, but with a couple opt-outs in there after each year, with performance bonuses going along as well, for a player that in recent years has been exclusively a right fielder. It's an interesting fit. We start off with what this could possibly mean for the center field situation. We are just days removed from Kim Ng addressing the media and reiterating that getting an offensive-minded center fielder was the top priority for them at that time. And we know, in particular, the one name that has been stressed about from at least local media has been their interest in Brian Reynolds of the Pittsburgh Pirates, a deal that I've reiterated is doubtful to happen before the start of the season from the Pirates' perspective. And there are some other potential options out there that you could get really creative with Ramon Laureano on the Oakland A's, still have to finish up his PED suspension. Somebody on Twitter floated to me the idea of trying to pry Harrison Bader from the St. Louis Cardinals. He certainly checks the boxes defensively and has at times been more than competent offensively as well. Yeah, but he is a very popular player among that fan base. When you look at options like that for teams that are pretty clearly in contention this upcoming season, it's going to be harder to agree to terms on a deal that is mutually beneficial for both sides. During a Twitter Spaces session that we had on Saturday night, Aram Layden floated the idea of Miles Straw of the Cleveland Guardians, I believe. Really speedy player who is coming off, I think, what would have to be his best full-length season in the majors. But the Guardians are a team that's kind of in the middle, just like the Marlins are, as to whether or not they're going to be contending this year or not. So there are still trade candidates out there, I guess, but you're dealing with a numbers game at some point. You know, if you're going to acquire another full-time sort of player in addition to Soler, in addition to who you already had, then inevitably somebody that we already know and had penciled in for this opening day roster is going to get squeezed off and more likely moved in a corresponding trade as well. It gets really messy if they try to do that. Absent the acquisition of another new player, the internal options they have are interesting. They have a handful of players that could potentially play center field. But we begin with probably Avisiel Garcia. Kim has been asked about whether he's an option in center field, and she has essentially said that he's an emergency option. He did play center field, played it poorly in the 2020 season, with the Brewers for reasons I've discussed on the site. There's reason to believe he's a little bit more competent than the defensive metrics and eye test would say. He was overweight during that 2020 season. As long as he's has more readiness for that challenge this year and has been conditioning himself appropriately, has been practicing it in spring training, at least behind the scenes, I think he could be more adequate than you would think as a center fielder. It's just the question of exactly whether he's good enough to pick up the slack of the limitations of his teammates. Soler is a liability defensively. A decent top-end speed, but not good reaction off the bat. The routes that he takes, even when he's just limited to one position in right field, he doesn't really have the tools to compensate for just a lack of instincts at that position. You need a good center fielder to fully make up for that. Avisaíl is probably not that guy. Jesus Sanchez, probably not that guy. It's a lot of similarities to Avisaíl, except even less actual center field experience in pro ball. And yeah, some of the same patterns with him where he's surprisingly agile for his size. It's just whether he has those instincts, that communication, that burst off the bat to be able to make those plays in the outfield, and especially to do it at a level that compensates for the limitations of his teammates. Brian De La Cruz is still here. He's on the 40-man roster. And yes, he has minor league options, but the way that he hit last year and the way that he defended, especially in the corner spots, but he showed already that he's more than just an emergency option in center field. He would be the best defensive option of those three if you can justify actually putting him in the starting lineup. That's a big question. Then the non-roster invitees in camp, I believe, are all three of them. I don't know if Brian Miller is technically in an NRI, but we saw him in the majors last year. He's already ready to kind of be pushed to the major league level if he fits on the roster, as well as the actual free agent minor league signings they brought in for center field, Roman Quinn and most recently Delino DeShields. Both those guys, and Quinn and DeShields, have pretty considerable major league experience. I can't see them actually pulling off the Reynolds trade or the Laureano trade before opening day, at least for the start of the season. This might be the outfield group that they have, making it work now with Soler joining the others and hoping that you can find the right combination between the conventional center field defender and those really exciting bats. It should not be underscored, you know, how much offensive potential both Avisaíl and Jesus have. And that goes a long way towards making up for any deficiencies that they bring you when forced into center field. Number two, big question coming off this signing is whether Soler can coexist on the roster with Garrett Cooper and Jesus Aguilar. There's some redundancy there. Soler is a flawed defensive player, and in that respect, you know, to fully take advantage of his skill set, you're going to be using him as a DH a considerable amount of time. The Braves, of course, did not have that option last year. This is going to be the first year where a universal designated hitter is into effect. Previously, when he was playing with the Royals, you know, the Royals did use him quite a bit as a DH to mitigate some of the limitations he has as a fielder. There's a lot of similarities between Soler and Cooper and Aguilar. They're all right-handed batters. Soler, actually, the youngest of the bunch. That might surprise people that Soler is younger than Aguilar or Cooper. They have, all three of them, pretty mild platoon splits. They are almost as trustworthy against right-handed pitching as they are against left-handed pitching. They're not obvious part-time platoon candidates. I'm not sure how that would work, especially with Cooper. We've seen that he is a streaky player. When things go bad, like they did early in 2021, in the middle of 2019, he's pretty useless, just to put it bluntly. On the other hand, when he heats up, he is legitimately one of the most dangerous hitters in all of baseball. We saw that leading up to the middle of the season this past year and at various times in 2019 as well. In 2018, for most of that year, yeah, he was pretty great. So with him, I think he's somebody that if he ever were to stay healthy, he profiles as an everyday player, not somebody you would really, you wouldn't platoon him, because when he's hot, he could hit pretty much anything. When he's not, then he takes a back seat. Aguilar is somebody that I think if you dive deep enough into it and look at how he performs against pitchers with certain release points or certain pitch mixes, he's somebody that could be very strategically rested against right-handed batters. That's kind of nitpicking, though, when you look at what he was doing for a lot of the 2021 season before his knee started bothering him. It's a good problem to have Soler and Cooper and Aguilar as potential middle of the order hitters. But the key is going to be with Cooper's like defensive fit right now. How do you fit them all in the same lineup? Presumably Soler and Wright and Aguilar and Cooper switching off between first base and DH. I don't think that's going to be the everyday alignment. As I said, you're going to want to DH Soler on occasion, and you're going to have to pay all three of these guys at the same time. Which from the outside, I think is a totally reasonable thing to expect from a Major League Baseball team. The question is whether, Bruce Sherman has the stomach for that. Soler earning $12 million this season. Arbitration projections for Cooper is $3 million, and for Aguilar, it is $7.4 million. We are still waiting on clarity as to exactly what those guys will be making during the 2022 season. So combined between all three, you're looking at right around $22 million between those three guys. Is ownership, willing to sign off on that? I think the key is going to be whether Cooper is okay to play the corner outfield spots in a pinch, on days where Soler needs the DH, or when Aguilar definitely needs the DH for an extended period, stuff like that. Cooper reportedly, from Joe Fusaro of Man on Second Baseball, he was under the impression that there would be no outfield in his diet for this season, understanding how that affects his injury risk and how his own defensive performance in the corner spots is shaky. Are they going to backtrack on that? Are they going to open up? Are they going to, tell him that he needs to a change of plans, that he needs to be prepared to play those corner spots on occasion? If not, it is just difficult for me to see all three of those guys on the team together. If you're not going to have that versatility to have two first baseman DH types, and yet to have, invest quite a bit in this player that is going to be an occasional DH for you as well. There's kind of this misconception that the designated hitter changes everything about offense in the National League. I feel that's been overstated. Already you had, in a typical game, you were using two, sometimes even three pinch hitters in the same game after the starting pitcher exits. There were already quite a bit of plate appearances available in what is in a hitting role. It was pinch hitting back then. Now it's DHing. Before, National League teams already had, close to half of a DH spot. And that's especially if you incorporate the interleague games that they played at American League parks. This doesn't magically open like 700 more plate appearances for the team. It's more like 300 or 350 that you didn't have last year that you have now. It's not a brand new full spot that appeared out of nothing. It's really half a spot that you now have and want to figure out how to use. I think what's clear is that they can't just sit on their hands from here. It's either trading one of those guys to address a position and make the roster more complementary, finding a way to get that last bullpen arm in a trade, or even some upper minor league depth that you could see contributing later in the year. The pieces don't really fit together all that perfectly with this move, understanding that this was not the plan from the beginning. The plan, once they signed Avasail primarily as a corner outfielder, is to bring in a second guy in center field, and pivoting to Soler the way they did, it solves some problems, but it creates new ones as well. When you're talking about how exactly he fits with the pieces they already had. Question number three I have coming out of the signing is, how much Soler's Cuban heritage impacted this decision. He is, you might be surprised by this, only the 10th major league player of Cuban descent that the Marlins have had. Most famously, Jose Fernandez and Levon Hernandez. Most recently, Odrysimer Despaigne from 2016 to 2018. There, Orestes Estrada, of course, was on the inaugural team in 93. And there are five other bit players mixed in there. So certainly some prominent ones with Levon and what he meant to the 97 World Series with Jose and how he performed so exceptionally well in his four Marlins seasons. Soler is the first big ticket veteran major leaguer to come via free agency and have that Cuban connection in him. This is notable. This is different from what they've done. This feels familiar to how fans were excited about potentially getting Yasiel Puig, two off seasons ago. We'll see if the actual anticipation for it converts to real life engagement that fans have with this team. Ultimately, I think you'll find out that they care a whole lot more about following a competitive team than they do a Cuban team. But Soler, both in his production and the style that he plays with, even outside of Cubanos, I mean, for somebody like me to watch him, it's a really sexy playing style. His tool set, the awesome raw power that he has, truly not at the very top of the scale. It's like just a tick below what we saw with Giancarlo Stanton for all those years. He's the closest they've had to that ever since then.
Swing and a drive, hammered down the line. Soler, a missile for a leadoff homer.
We know certainly from his side, it was appealing to play for the Marlins. He makes his offseason home in Miami, and he has for quite a while now. So from him, it makes a lot of sense. And I imagine, especially early in the year, there are going to be some marketing perks that the Marlins reap from having a Cuban player in the middle of their lineup almost every single day, and one that finished last season performing so well, and especially in the most critical moment, winning the World Series MVP with the Braves. Like, there's a lot to like about that. But this goes into point number four. Question number four is whether the adjustments that he made in the middle of the 2021 season are legit. If you look at the price that they paid for Soler, they are seemingly betting quite a bit that the second half Soler is the one that they'll be getting for the next several years. He was not playing well at all when the Royals traded him to the Braves, moved for just two very marginal prospects, a glorified salary dump by the Royals to the Braves because he was playing so poorly early in the 2021 season for a team that was out of contention. So what you see when you look a little closer is that there may have been some bad luck in play with how he was performing early on, that maybe he was not quite as bad as he thought. According to StatCast, there were a handful of home runs that batted potential home runs based on the batted ball quality that simply stayed in the park due to where he was playing or the climate that he was playing in, the particular direction that he was hitting those balls. If you were to control for some of those variables, he could have been more productive with the Royals than he actually was. But the bottom line stats were really ugly. A 192 batting average, a 658 OPS, only about 75% of a league average hitter when you adjust for the league and the ballpark. And really, it was a continuation of what had been his issue throughout his career, is swinging and missing for his career, even including the 2021 season. He strikes out 27% of the time. And during his portion of the 2021 season with the Royals, it was 27%. This was on the heels of a COVID-shortened year in 2020, where he struck out 34.5%. More than one-third of his plate appearances in 2020 were strikeouts. That's a number that, regardless of how hard you hit the ball, is very difficult to overcome that and be a legitimate, everyday, middle-of-the-order hitter the way that he was in 2019. I'll be interested to see exactly what sort of player the Marlins envision him being moving forward. There was the 2019 season where he hit 48 home runs, where there was a considerable amount of swing and miss, but so much game power and a lot of discipline as well at the plate. That's something that I think people may be missing about Soler, is for a decent chunk of his career, he has been disciplined. He does lay off. He does not chase pitches out of the zone the way that you might expect. He's somebody that has that element in his game. It was just a matter of bat to ball skills and pitch recognition, you know, when it comes to actually doing damage on balls that were in the zone. And that's something that was kind of lacking for his game, from his game for a lot of 2021. And after the trade, it was almost like a switch flipped. And down the stretch with the Braves, hit 269, had an 882 OPS. That's awesome. And his strikeout rate plummeted. So from being 27% with the Royals early in the year, which was considerably worse than league average, he dropped it to 18.6%, which is much better than league average, and which is far lower than it had ever been in any season of his career. So that was something that was totally new, that an adjustment you don't really see from a 29-year-old. And when you dig into the, you know, the numbers a little bit more, you see somebody that was kind of making a conscious adjustment in that regard. Just not swinging with as much ferocity as he had been earlier in the year. That was mostly a good thing. He was using the opposite field more. And again, just kind of toning down the ferocity of his swing. And a part of this was just some of his luck evening out with those long fly balls going over the wall. And also on batting average on balls in play. Like, his BABIP early in 2021 was one of the lowest in baseball among qualified hitters. And that started to creep up closer to his career average later on. If he is fully that player that he was in late 2021 for the next several years, then he's, especially if he is that player for this upcoming season, then it's really complicated with the setup of this deal. You know, if he continues to be the Braves version of himself in 2022 and he stays healthy, then he's going to probably raise his stock so much that it'll be tantalizing for him to opt out of the final 2 years and $24 million of his deal. Finally, as we wrap up this podcast, the fifth question in the aftermath of the Soler signing is in regards to that contract and how long we can expect him to be here. It's usually not that complicated. Most contracts that have been signed in Marlins history, even if they're multi-year deals, maybe there's a club option attached to the end of it. Maybe there are certain incentives involved. This would seem to be a first to have multiple opt-outs in the same multi-year deal. He has an option to opt out after the 2022 season and again in 2023. That first salary is going to be $12 million. Then it jumps up to $15 million to entice him to stay one more year. And then in that third year, the base salary is only $9 million, but it can go up to $13 million if he hits performance bonuses that are only tied to plate appearances. If he makes, if he's a qualified hitter in that final season, he gets most of that money. The incentives start, I believe, at, 350 plate appearances. So if he just plays half the season as a starter, then it goes up to $9.5 million, and then it ticks up to 10, and then 11 and 12, and it maxes out at 13 if he makes 550 plate appearances in that final year. So they're really, this is kind of a 5A and a 5B, you know, the question of whether or not he opts out of this deal at a certain point and whether or not he's actually a Marlin, even if he stays for all 3 years. So the second part is almost impossible to say. The first part, I would lean towards the most likely scenario here being that he actually does stay for all 3 years. The only way that he thoroughly kind of outperforms those final 2 years of the deal is if he stays mostly healthy and if his numbers pretty closely resemble the Braves 2021 version of himself. And certainly if he somehow gets back to the 2019 version where he was right around a 5-win player, or excuse me, actually, that was just on the offensive side. If you incorporate his full elements to his game, the peak version of him in 2019 It was only about 3.5 wins above replacement. Let's see. It was 3.5 according to Baseball Reference. And from Fangraphs, what do they have it at? Also 3.6. So that is the realistic ceiling. I don't think he's going to have the best year of his life at age 30. But maybe he does revert back to that 2019 form, in which case it would make sense to opt out and look for a new multi-year deal at age 31. I still think the realistic expectation is for something less than that in such a way that it makes it tantalizing to stay where he's at for 2023. Again, he'll have that option again to opt out after the 2023 season. And even though the base salary does tumble quite a bit entering 2024, at that point, he's going to be a 32-year-old. We don't think the fielding is going to get any better. It's not just the struggles to be a good fielder. It's also just the lack of versatility that he has been exclusively a right field DH type since 2018. Yeah, 2017 was the last time he even played an inning in the regular season in another position. That was in left field for the Royals. When somebody is that limited with their versatility and just grades out pretty negatively as a defender, it doesn't give you much on the bases either. It should be noted that, you know, he hasn't stolen a base or even attempted a steal in 3 years. That type of player is being devalued in baseball these days. He was able to get the deal that he did, I guess, because he is younger than you would think. The fact that this is going to be his age 30 season, I think for that reason, he was able to cash in the way that he did. Every year after that, it gets almost exponentially harder for somebody to get to be trusted to maintain their level of production moving forward. That's what we've seen from the way that front offices operate. And if he, even if he does well in 2023, you know, because of his age, and even though $4 million of those performance bonuses are hardly guaranteed, they're just kind of contingent on him being a regular in that lineup. So if he finishes off 2023 and things are going pretty well, and he at least has that security of a job at either right field or DH or a combination of both, it's going to be tempting for him to opt in and stay for that security and to stay in a place that he is as comfortable as can be. You know, that is a big element of how this came together, is him wanting to be in Miami year round, where, you know, he already makes his offseason home with his wife and with his children. I think that plays a little part into it. As long as he feels relatively confident in being playing close to every day, you know, moving forward that next year and understanding those bonuses are well within reach, that's pretty likely. You know, the wrinkle in it, of course, is if he gets traded between now and then. If the Marlins are not in contention by the middle of this season and they expect, but yet he is doing his part and they feel it is a significant threat that he opts out of his deal, they'll be tempted to make a move in that regard. It'll be extremely unpopular, of course. It is something that, you know, we need to consider when you look at the strength of this National League East division. For all the Marlins have done on both before and after the lockout, have they really closed the gap all that much with the Mets and with the Phillies and with the Braves as well? I think a little bit, for sure with all those teams, but enough to, like, you know, confidently project them to stay in the playoff mix all season long. We need to be prepared, you know, for a worst case scenario where potentially they are in the same situation they were last year, where they're what, 10, 12 games under 500 by the middle of the season. If the rest of the offense around Soler doesn't deliver, or if, as much as we think about this young pitching staff, you know, it's a new challenge for them to be in this division that is absolutely loaded with bats. I can't stress that enough, how much offensive firepower this division has from teams investing quite a bit to surround the familiar faces we already knew with newcomers like Matt Olson on the Braves and Castellanos and Schwarber on the Phillies. Starling Marte obviously flipping and going to the Mets. The Mets getting Mark Canna in free agency as well. Like, this team didn't take a step back, and at the very least, in the case of with the Phillies and the Mets, they both seem to be more formidable than they were last year. It's not the Marlins in a vacuum just trying to get better. It's also accounting for the opponents that make up nearly half of your regular season schedule. It's a pretty imposing situation that they're up against. Thankfully, they did something to, you know, draw themselves within reach of those other teams. It was a grim outlook if they weren't able to get an above average bat to, you know, finish off their lineup. So thankfully, Soler is here. It's going to be a fun honeymoon. You know, whether it, you know, carries over for the entire length of his 3-year deal, it's hard to say. Ultimately, I think it's hard to really be too negative about this particular deal, just because it's not a huge risk. And again, the worst case scenario is he makes $15 million in 2023. And that's a year before the Marlins really have to make any other huge investments in their homegrown core. You know, Jazz is still going to be pre-arbitration eligible. Trevor is still going to be pre-arb as well. Sandy's backloaded extension is backloaded for that reason. It does not, most of the money does not kick in until 2025. And some of those other guys that are still have an extra year of control moving forward, everybody from Joey Wendell to Jacob Stallings to even Brian Anderson to Miguel Rojas, he's locked in at a reasonable number for 2023. So Soler could completely flop and be, you know, either so mediocre or so risky from a health standpoint that they're unable to move him at any point during the year. Even if you enter 2023 and you're kind of stuck with him without knowing exactly how to utilize him, it's not going to necessarily drag down and doom the team from turning that second year into a competitive one. You know, they don't need him to be an everyday player for this to work out. That is what they're hoping, though. You know, that is what they're hoping, is that these adjustments that he made last year, that the abilities that he showed in 2019 are still there for somebody that is seemingly in the prime of his career. I feel confident in predicting that this is not the final tweak you would see to the Marlins 40-man roster between now and opening day. You don't necessarily have to trust that every button they push is the right one, but their intentions are good. They are trying to optimize this roster for the 2022 season. And that is exciting. This is really the first time, certainly since the ownership change, that you felt that they are kind of pulling in that direction. Hopefully, they get the support from the highest level, from ownership, from Bruce Sherman, you know, to spend any additional money to bring this all home. You know, for the time being, you would think that with all the revenue sources that they have and a return to normalcy when it comes to the fan experience and the television broadcast rights, that they would be able to afford to add even more on top of this. But it's hard for me to be anything but, you know, slightly relieved to see them add that additional bat in Jorge Soler. This has been Eli Sussman for the official show. So many more angles of the signing to break down. And I mean, by the time I put this out, it might be official. Just waiting on that word to come to get the deal done and to make potential corresponding moves on the heels of it in order to get ready for opening day. We're going to have podcasts on this feed 5 days a week, at least for the foreseeable future. We hope you listen in, support the pod, share the pod, as well as all the Fish Stripes coverage that we provide on our many different platforms. Thanks for tuning in. Go Fish.